He has 60 years of married bliss, and he has 80 years of his natural life. So there's 40, 60, and 80 coming up on the stage now to share his story with us today. Shorty from Kennewick.
Are you going to hear me if I talk like into this without my holding it? Well, I'm Shorty and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm tremendously happy to be able to be here. Some people have had to go to a lot of trouble so that I could be here. And I just want you to give a nice hand to Jerry, who took off from work so he could drive me over here and be with me. Jerry, stand up. I think you should know a little bit about the speaker. What he does for a living, for instance, you know most of you what I did for a living. I peddled jock straps. And for you women, if you don't understand what that means you're an athletic equipment salesman. And I don't go much into a drunkalogue. Not that I don't believe in them. They're essential. But I have something I want to say, and you folks can't sit that long if I'm to give my drunkalogue. I usually qualify myself with one statement. My wife doesn't happen to be here this time. But if you want any doubts about whether I'm eligible to the AA program, just talk to her a little while. Because the one thing I will say about my past, I used to say I drank to a point where my family could get along better without me than with me. That they could, but that wasn't it. I deserted my family when we had 7 children. Disregarded that they would have to go on welfare, that the hardships they would have by not having any income. I started wandering around, not knowing where to go, really. We lived in Spokane then. We'd moved there. And I started wandering down the coast, away from that family. And I ended up in Skid Row in San Francisco. Now, I had a good family. But I was one of those individuals that just had to do it their way. I'd had fine jobs. I'd got canned for drinking. I had fine jobs. I got canned for drinking. I'd gotten to where I was not employable any longer. I got to a point where I was afraid not to drink. I had been told that I didn't have to have the DTs and I didn't have to have a seizure. I should get smart about this drinking business and see to it that I always had a little alcohol in my system, because you can't have the DTs and you can't have a seizure with alcohol in your system. It's when it gets out of your system that you have it. So, and I was afraid of the DTs, and I was afraid of the seizures, and so I was afraid not to drink. When I first came on the program, I got to digress a little. I don't make much order to my speeches. When I came on this program, I got into the service structure, and I lived in White Salmon for 12 years, and I was a loner there for 3 years. And I got into service, and I served in service, and I was called. We didn't use our last names at all when I came in. We used our last initials. And so I was known as Shorty of White Salmon. That was the identification I had. I went over to Spokane to speak at their 10th anniversary of their Alano Club, and the lady got up and introduced me, and she was a little nervous, and she says, "Our speaker tonight is Whitey of Short Salmon." And some of them still call me that around the area. But the worst one I ever had, I was traveling as I become a traveling salesman and selling athletic equipment to the schools, and I was assigned to Wyoming when I first got sober and back to where I could work and be depended on. And I come to Casper, Wyoming, and they had a little clubhouse. I went and hunted it up. It was a 12 by 24 foot stone block, cement block house that they had built themselves. And I drove up to the door, and there was a car outside, and I went in, the lady was in there, and I introduced myself and told her that I was a traveling man that was belonged to AA, and I would be staying there for a couple of days, and I'd like to come to a meeting. And she said, "That's fine. I'm chairman tonight. Are you coming tonight?" And I says, "Yes, I'm coming tonight." And she said, "That's fine. Will you say something?" And I says, "Well, that'll be all right, too." And so when I got there, and she got up to introduce me, and she says, "We have a guest here tonight, and I've asked him to talk a little while. He works for the Bill Hatch Sporting Goods out of Spokane, and he sells sporting house equipment." And now you younger folks, talk to some of the older folks and they'll explain that one to you. So I get a little afraid of these introductions once in a while. But if you think because I'm somebody of authority and management and that, and I'm invited here, I better straighten you out. I was traveling on the road, and I come home. We lived in White Salmon then, and I came home and Friday night, and I knew that I'd be busy over the weekend settling some of the family problems and making some of the decisions for the family, and so that they could get along when I was gone again for a couple, 3 weeks. And I walked in the house, and right there in the middle of the floor is a sewing machine. I says, "What's that?" Says, "It's a sewing machine." "Whose is it?" "It's ours." "What do you mean by ours?" "The girls and me." And I says, "Who bought it?" "We did." "How come I didn't know anything about it?" They just shrugged their shoulders. I went over and sat down in my chair, and I says, "Once and for all, we're going to find out who's boss around here." My wife looked at me, and she says, "Shorty, I think you'd be a lot happier if you never found out." Well, I got down to San Francisco on Skid Row, and two guys picked me up. I didn't know anything about Skid Row, and they saw I was a greenhorn, and they asked me if I had any money, and I says no, and they says, "You better have to learn how to get along if you're going to stay down here." And so they took me under their wing, and they taught me how to mooch and beg and score. They taught me how to steal little things without getting caught. They taught me how to fix up a big cardboard box with newspapers wadded in it and drag it under the Bay Bridge and out of the rain and sleep in. And they taught me how to get ready for selling a pint of blood every 2 weeks. And I get $5 for that. And that was payday. And then they also taught me the routing of the paddy wagons. And the paddy wagon there would come by that street starting at 4 o'clock and pick up the drunks that were laying in the street or looked like they would be laying in the street very shortly. And I followed their directions, and I was never on that street at 4 o'clock in the afternoon except one day I forgot. And I got thrown in the paddy wagon. And I got thrown in the drunk tank. See, this was before the days where they rewarded you for being a drunk by getting you a nice bed and medication and all this stuff. They just threw you in the drunk tank. And I say to this day, that did more towards my thinking seriously about not drinking than anything else. Because that drunk tank was just a slab of cement that was overcrowded when they got about 70 in there. And after all of them had been in there about 2 hours, they all contracted the same illness, known as puking. And we were so close together that we couldn't miss each other. And the floor got so slick that you didn't want to lay on it or sit on it, and you didn't dare stand up because you'd slip down. And we went through a night that was really horror. And when I was sentenced the next morning to get to 24 hours to get out of town, I went across to the south side of Market Street again over to 3rd Minna Street, which was near the heart of Skid Road. And I went and crawled on a garbage can back in the alley of 3rd Minna. And I did some serious thinking. And I thought, Shorty, you can never go stand another night in that drunk tank. You can't permit yourself to. And then as I started thinking, I started figuring, well, what am I going to do? So I made up my mind I was either going to get rid of my drinking or I was going to get rid of myself. And I knew I couldn't get rid of my drinking. During my drinking, I had my wife had me go to a minister. And we spent all Sunday afternoon on our knees praying. And when we were done and he found out I didn't care to pray with him, he says, we'll try it again sometime. And I got up and walked 2 blocks down the street to a tavern and had some beer to stop my knees from aching. Then the doctor started taking hold of me, saying, "You're looks like you're going to have some liver and kidney trouble if you don't stop drinking, Shorty." Well, he didn't scare me either. I left his office and went to the place where I usually went and drank. A psychiatrist took a hold of me once because I applied for a job and they thought I was just right for it, except there was a rumor I had a drinking problem. And so one of the men on the board was a friend of mine. He says, "I want you to go see a friend of mine. It won't cost you anything. It'll be taken care of." So he sent me to a psychiatrist. And we had quite a time for 3-4 sessions until I finally made his life unmanageable. And of course, I knew the secret of working with a psychiatrist. Just don't tell them the truth, and they're helpless. And I wouldn't tell him the truth. I could tell you some things I did tell him, but that's neither here nor there. You folks have heard of them from everybody. And so that didn't work. Then I went to a liquor cure. Not these elaborate ones now. Somebody, I don't know who paid for it now, but somebody who needed it cost $200 or $300, and you were there 4 days. It was called the Murray Liquor Cure. And I was in there, and they fed me liquor of the most delicious kinds. And then after they'd fed me and got me pretty souped up, they'd put a Mickey in it, and I would be so sick. I puked in many, many delicious flavors. And they said, "That's fine." And so then they brought me some more whiskey. And I liked two kinds at that time. I liked Old Forester, and I liked Ancient Age. And they brought them to me. And they just kept pouring 2-ounce shots to me. And I'd get all souped up again, and then come that Mickey. And, oh, boy, what a session I went through. I did that for 4 days. And then they come in, and I just started smelling the bottle, and bingo, I started throwing up. They says, you're doing fine. And so I got in front of the doctor, and he says, "I think you're ready to go home, Shorty. But I want to warn you that you don't want to even go into any place where it smells liquor. You're going to embarrass yourself by throwing up. You've got to absolutely stay away from it forever." Boy, that was like a death sentence. But I went home, and I wandered around for a couple of days, and I was just having it so miserable. And all of a sudden, some little angel said to me, "Why don't you get a second opinion? Maybe that doctor wasn't telling the truth." And so I went and bought a half a pint of bourbon. I went up an alley, and I got beside one of these big telephone poles they had in those days that had those iron steps out there, and I hung on. I opened this bottle, and I took a good slug. In a few minutes, I found out he was right. I threw up, and I threw up. And then I realized that I was resigned to a life of hell, not being able to drink. And I stood there holding that bottle, and it was still half full. And I thought, well, if I'm not going to drink the rest of my life, I better have one last good one. And so I took and threw the rest of it down. And I stood there. And I stood there. And all of a sudden I realized I wasn't throwing up. Boy, that doctor lied to me. I could drink again. And I went on drinking. None of the things that I'd tempted. And there I sat on that barrel. And I knew I'd have to either get rid of myself or get rid of my drinking, and I knew I couldn't get rid of my drinking. So I was going to get rid of myself. I was going to be sensational about it. I was going to jump off the Bay Bridge. And you know the Bay Bridge. You've seen enough pictures of it. It's 7 miles from Oakland over to San Francisco, and one of those ramps in San Francisco from Skid Row that goes up on that bridge, it's 2 miles uphill before you get over the water. And there I am shaking, unable to walk 2 miles uphill, but knowing if I got a few snorts under my belt, I maybe could do it. So I went out and scored, because I had to get that's 2 miles to get over the water to jump. No fool is not going to jump before he's over the water. He might land on a building and hurt himself. And so I was back the next morning, but shaking. No, here again, I can't do it. And I went out and scored for drinks, but always when I got enough under my belt to think I could do it, why, it was too late in the day. Now, I don't know if it was the third or fourth day, but I had 40 cents in my pocket. And I knew now I could go across to Visadero there over to the joint I drank in when I did have any money. And the bartender would give me at least 2 good shots for that. They were 15 cents apiece in those days. And often give you the third one on the house. And so now I knew I was going to be able to do it. And I ran across that street to get the drinks. And as I come to the joint, outside the joint, was going to walk in, I bumped into a guy purposely because he didn't belong down there. He had a nice top coat on, he had a hat on, he had a nice suit and tie. And he looked like he was prosperous. And I resented him being down there amongst us and showing off. And I bumped into him pretty hard, and he was big, and somehow or other I wasn't afraid. But he just turned around and he grabbed me by both shoulders. And he says, "Fella, you drink too much." And I says, "Who the hell doesn't know that?" And he says, "Would you like to be sober?" And I says, facetiously, "Anybody'd like to be sober." He says, "That wasn't what I asked you. I asked you if you'd like to be sober." And he says, "I don't happen to be the kind that can be sober." He says, "I don't even ask you if you think you can be sober." And I says, "Who are you, the Salvation Army or somebody?" And he says, "No, I'm just a fellow that used to be down here like you are. And you look so much like I must have looked when I was down here. I want to tell you that you don't need to drink if you don't want to." Now, Providence, somehow or other, made me go listen to him. Made me go into this little restaurant and sit with 2 other AA members and himself, telling me I didn't have to drink if I didn't want to. But they asked me if I had enough money to rent a room, because they says, "This isn't a tapering off process, this is a quitting process. And you've been drinking pretty heavy and you'll be awfully sick. And if you got enough for a room, we'll help you." Well, I didn't. They says, "All right." So they chipped in together $3.50. And they got me a room for several nights for that money. And they took me up to it, a little rambly place above a used furniture store down there in Skid Row. And they stayed with me in turns. One of them took me to the end of the hall and gave me a shower. Another one went down to the Salvation Army and got some clean clothes for me. And the other guy went and got some juices and different things he wanted me to drink. And they took turns coming and taking care of me. And all I did was sip on something and puke. And it went on all night. And they were right. I was going to be awfully sick. And all the next day it went on. And towards that evening, one of the guys come up with a container that they make milkshakes in. And I looked in, it was white and it was thick looking. And he says, "You drink this." I says, "I can't drink that. You know that." And he says, "You're going to drink it." Well, I had to drink it. And I drank it down. And just like I told him I'd throw up, I started throwing up again. And when I was done throwing up, he says, "That's wonderful." I says, "What's wonderful about it?" He says, "You didn't throw it all up. There's something down there now you can fasten on to." And sure enough, I could start drinking the juices and things. The next night, towards 6 o'clock, all three of them came and they took me down the stairs. Took me over to a little Italian restaurant that had these big bowls of soup in the center of the table. And we ate six Italian soup. And I ate lots of it and I didn't throw up. They says, "Now you're going to an AA meeting." So they took me to Bush Street, the old French Catholic Church on Bush Street, the downtown group, which today is a huge group in St. Mary's Cathedral. But then it was about, there was about 30 people there. And I was still shaking and sitting in, on my hands. And I got in there. And I knew I was in the wrong place. You know what those so-and-sos did? They opened with a prayer. Now, if there's one thing I didn't want, didn't need, was a prayer. I was the youngest son of an old-fashioned Methodist minister. And I grew up on prayer. I grew up on restrictions that were unbelievable. My folks, everything I seemed to want to do that was any fun, they said was a sin, and if I sinned, I wouldn't go to heaven. And if I didn't go to heaven, I wouldn't be able to walk the golden streets. And so I wanted to play, we were good athletes, three of us boys. And I wanted to play ball on Sunday. That was a sin, and you wouldn't go to heaven. I wanted to go with some of the kids to a show. No, that was a sin. I wanted to play cards with them. That was a sin. I wanted to go to the dances. That's a sin. It seemed like everything that was fun was sin. And when was I going to have fun? When I got to heaven and got to walk the golden streets. Boy, what a reward for all that restriction. And I decided it was a bum deal, and I wasn't going to have anything to do with this God that didn't let us have any fun and didn't have a reward that was worth very much either. And so I resigned myself from all belief in anything religious, belief in anything that had the word God on it, belief in anything spiritual. And I stayed away from it. I'm telling you, I stayed away from it. But I started drinking. I started doing all the things that I was deprived of, I felt. And I did pretty well with my drinking for a while. I didn't do too well when I went to the senior picnic. Three of us were together, and we took the Model T Ford, and we drove out to the senior picnic, but we were going to be a little more sensational than anybody else. We decided that we needed a pint of pure alcohol. This was Prohibition days. We got the pure alcohol and a couple quarts of mix. We started for the picnic. We stopped outside the picnic ground. We slugged ourselves a time or two and then stashed the liquor near a telephone pole and drove into the picnic. Started playing softball, but in a little while one of us snuck back and helped himself to some more. A little while later, all three snuck back and helped themselves to some more. This same guy kept sneaking back there and helping himself to some more. And finally, he passed out. And that was a shame in the community. A little town of 1,700 people. His dad, the Methodist minister in town. And he passes out drunk. It was a scandal. In fact, they were thinking about not letting me graduate because of it. And that was my first experience with drinking any amount. And if I'd known then what I know about alcohol today, I'd known that perhaps I better leave it alone. Because I did something that's typical of the alcoholic. Maybe not for any of you folks, but for me it was. I took more than my share. Yeah, I saw to it I got more than my share. Well, it went along. And I'm not going through any of the other stories. But I was down there in my first meeting. And I wanted to leave. But I didn't dare because they'd driven me there in a car and I didn't know where I was. I knew I had a night or two of sleep coming in that flop house, but I didn't know how to get there, so I didn't dare leave until after the meeting. And I sat there realizing that I was in the wrong place, and somebody talked about God, and boy, I shuddered. And another guy said something about it being a spiritual program, and I thought, well, here's this holy roller starting to operate again on me. And then to add insult to injury, they closed with a prayer. And I got up to leave. But then something happened that is sacred almost in AA. It's one of our most important characteristics, and we neglect to use it. As I got up, those three fellows were there at the meeting. And they came over to me and says, Shorty, we want you to go down to the club for coffee. And all of a sudden I realized somebody cared about me. These guys really care. I haven't got a dime. I can't help them in any way. And yet they want to help me. And that rung a bell. And that I went with them. And we drank coffee until too late to get drunk. And they took me down to the flop house that night. And the next morning one of them picked me up at 6 o'clock and drove me around the Bay Area while he made calls on his customers. He dumped me off at the club that night. I was mad about that because I thought he'd dump me off someplace where I could get a drink. And no, he took me right up to the club. And I went to my second meeting. And I got to my second meeting. And I sat there. And my sponsor, Jack Irving, his name was, he used to be head of the fellowship in San Francisco, the Bay Area, the inner group. And Jack come up to me, a hard-boiled used car salesman. He come up to me and he says, I'm your sponsor. And I says, what's a sponsor? He says, you'll soon find out. And he says, now when I'm your sponsor, I have some rules you're going to have to follow. I says, wait a minute, what's this all about suggestions and you saying rules? Well, the suggestion is that you work the program. The rules is that you work them. But you get in, you do them. And now, as far as I'm concerned, they're rules. And I'm going to lay the rules down. And they're good to this day. I practice them to this day. I have no right to practice any other way because it worked for me. He says, first, you're going to call me for the next 30 days at dinner time. There's a free phone up at the club, so you don't have to holler you ain't got a nickel. And if I'm not there, Ada, my wife, will be. Just tell us you're all right. That's okay. Secondly, you're going to attend at least one meeting a week with me so I can see how you're doing. And you better have a good reason for missing because I won't accept any excuse. Because I have to see how you're coming along. Third, you're going to have to get it out of the horse's mouth, which is the big book called Alcoholic Anonymous. And I says, I don't have any money for one. He says, you don't need any money for one. You go up to the club. They got two of them up there, and you can sit and read them. You're not working. We don't give you books. We found out when we give people books, they don't put any value on it. We'll loan you a book. We'll tell you where you can read it. But we want you to buy your own book. The first paycheck you got, we want to see you buy it. And he says, then there's another thing you're going to have to give of yourself. And you can start now. And I said, I got nothing to give. Oh, yes, you have. There's 40 chairs that have to be stacked after every meeting. You will, for the next month, stack those 40 chairs neatly in that corner. You'll start giving of yourself. And I listened to those things. And I stayed around the club. My ego was working against me. I wouldn't accept the offers for employment to give me. They were too menial for me. Those people didn't understand me. They didn't know who I was. And one day I told my sponsor that. And he grinned. He says, we don't care who you are. We know what you are. And that's the basis we're going to work on. And he kept grinding down at it and grinding down on this. And I would keep refusing little jobs to rake somebody's lawn or go wash dishes or help somebody do something. And I would go without meals rather than give in to my ego, let my ego down. And I would, one place I'd go, I would walk Market Street, window shopping, after the club closed at 11 o'clock, because I didn't have money for a flop. And 6 o'clock in the morning, I'd be in front, on a little hotel on Pine Street where Margaret, she was on the program, she took care, she was a housekeeper. She put on a, 6 o'clock in the morning, she put on a pot of coffee in the back there, and we'd go in the back door, and she'd get a sack full of week-old rolls or donuts from the bakery driver, and we'd sit there, dunk those things, and eat them. And that sometimes was my whole meal for the day. And I went along this way, complaining, but I didn't drink. And then one day, sitting up in the club, I'm heading to any work yet. Weeks had gone by. And a guy come up and sat down up there. And he says, "Hiya, Shorty." And I says, "How are you?" He was the chef for the Golden Pheasant, fine restaurant. He says, "Got a job?" I says, "Nope." He says, "You got one now." I said, "What do you mean?" "I'll give you a job." "What doing?" "Washing dishes." I says, "To hell with it." He says, "Now listen here, Shorty, you're going to take this job and you're going to wash dishes. It isn't even a full-time one. But you're going to work 5 days a week, 4 hours during the noon hour rush. And then you're going to get to eat any kind of a meal we've got. And you can come in Saturday and Sunday when you're not working and get a meal each day. And you'll make $22 a week." And those meals, they made me give in. I went. Oh, I hated it. I looked up and down the street, see if anybody was seeing me go in the employee's door. I was so afraid people were going to find out I washed dishes. And I went down those stairs, and I started washing that dishwashing machine. And I did what they told me to do, and I got my first paycheck, $22. I had borrowed a dollar from a guy up at the club, and I promised him faithfully the first dollar would be his. And I went up there after work to give him that. But Providence saw that my sponsor Jack was sitting up there. And Jack says, "What's that you got?" I says, "I got paid." He says, "Fine." And he took $3.50 from me and bought me a big book. Now there is the meanest man in the world. And he not only bought me the book, and then he took me aside and set me down and says, "Now I'm going to teach you how to read the big book." And I followed. He says, "First, you're going to read the preface. Then you're going to read the doctor's opinion. And then I want you to read the rest of the book, but just for the time being, so you can get a good start on this program, I want you to open it up to chapter 5 and read the first 2.5 pages. Not once, not twice. But I want you to give me your promise that when you go to bed each night, you will reopen that book and read slowly out loud to yourself those first 2.5 pages down to where it says A, B, and C. And the reason I want you to read it slowly out loud is because then you won't skip any words. And then you'll both hear and see what you're reading. We impetuous alcoholics, we usually read part of the first sentence and decide we know what it's going to say in the rest of the paragraph, so we skip it. I want you to do this. You got to do that 15 nights in a row. And I says, "What the heck? I hear it at the meetings." He says, "Books are to be read by people, not to people." Well, I had found that out. I had been invited up to read the preamble once, and I was worried because in the program someplace was they seemed to insinuate that you should abstain from any sex, and that bothered me. And then I got up to read this preamble, and I read down halfway, and I stopped. It didn't say sex at all. It said sect. And boy, that changed my attitude towards AA. And so I did what he said. I read it slowly out loud. And I did this for about 3-4 nights, and then one night I come home a little late. I'd been playing pinochle at the club or something, and I just turned the light off, pulled that chain in the center of the room, and crawled into bed. I couldn't go to sleep. Finally, I got up and turned the light on and took my book, and I read it slowly out loud to myself, and when I got done, I put it away and I went to sleep. Oh, I read it the next few nights, I'm sure, because I was afraid if I didn't, I wouldn't go to sleep. But then words started jumping out at me. Words that I thought I knew the meaning of, and all of a sudden I wondered, do I? Then I realized it was trying to tell me what I should do in order to have the benefit of the steps. I began recognizing it as qualifying me for the program. And I read it, and it didn't just say, rarely does a person fail. It said, rarely does a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And it said a little farther down there, you have to have the capacity to be honest. That's one of the requirements for this program. But how me? I haven't got an honest bone in my body. How can I take on any honesty? And so I went to Dr. Poliak, who was the head of the psychopathic ward of the San Francisco Hospital and was a very good friend of AA. In fact, he's written about in AA Comes of Age. And he was very kind to we AA members. And I went up to him and I says, if you're not too busy, I'd like you to answer me a question, doctor. And he says, what is it, Shorty? And I says, what does it mean to have the capacity to be honest? And he says, are you worried about it? I says, yes. He says, you don't need to. There ain't over one in 10,000 that doesn't have the capacity to be honest. Well, what does it mean? He says, it means that you know the difference between right and wrong. You have to know the difference between right and wrong. Well, I knew the difference between right and wrong. And then I went on and another word started jumping out at me. It said, rigorous honesty. Holy man, you're going to make me work. But then I had followed the suggestion of my sponsor that the two most important books in AA are the Big Book and a dictionary. And I'd secured a dictionary. And I looked up what rigorous meant. And of all the definitions I found out it meant doing my best. That's being rigorous. Well, you know, I might not do very good, but as long as I did my best, perhaps I had a chance. And so I went on reading, and it told me I had to get rid of my old ideas. I didn't have any, except that I knew if I had a good job and my wife would let me come back, and I had a decent car to drive, I knew I wouldn't have to drink. Well, I tried that several times. I had to get rid of that old idea. That was the solution. And I went along on this thing, and then I went through the steps, and then it came to me, and in after the steps were read, it gave another thing that gave me encouragement. It didn't say I had to be perfect. It didn't say I was going to learn how to do this exceptionally good. It said no one of us is going to be perfect. It indicated that all I had to do was do my best, and my best would keep me sober. And so I went through this book, and I started being active in AA. And I started studying the steps. I had been told by my sponsor, that they are so simple and so plain that they don't need any analyzing. And then I found out I didn't want to analyze them either. I found out it consisted of two words. One was anal, and the other was lies. And I didn't want any part of that. And so I didn't analyze them. Just accept what it said. And knowing Jim Burwell finally and getting his explanation of things, I went and accepted what it said. I accepted the first step. I could realize that I had to reach outside of myself for help, which is the second step. And the third step was really baffling me. I didn't have a God I understood. The God I knew was an old meanie. He was going to get me if I made a mistake. I didn't understand that kind of a God. And here in the AA, they talk about love and all that stuff. And here they're telling me about a God that I believed was really out to get me. And then I went and I talked to one of the old members, one of the guys that was in on the writing of the steps. And he told me this, don't let the third step bother you. Read it in the present tense. Don't read it in the past tense. Those steps were written about people, what they had done to get sober. Now you read it as something you're going to have to do to stay sober. And so I went home and I did. I put it in the present tense. I said, I have to make a decision that I will turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And I settled for that. I made the decision. A decision is not a word of action. You know that. You've made many decisions and never did anything. But I made a decision that I kept. That if an understanding of God would come along, I would turn my will and my life over to Him. And I kept on with the steps. I was comfortable now. I didn't worry about the third step anymore. Because I had started to have a feeling that I would get my answers that I didn't understand in these steps. But then come that fourth step, which is so abused. And I get this from the people that were in on the writing. It's abused. They fought Bill to keep out the religious part of it. A lot of people interpret the fourth step as that you got to go back and remember every stinking thing you ever did and write it down. Why, my gosh, that's the greatest depression factory that was ever conceived. This isn't a program we go back and dig up and dig up. This is a program we look forward. It says a moral inventory. Look it up in the dictionary what moral means. It means your character. Look up what the word character means. It means the principles you practice in living. And that's how they wrote that step. But it's gotten, people have got analyzing it and making it fancy, can't accept a simple answer. And so I was told by my sponsor, go stick yourself over in the corner and take a good look at yourself. And see what kind of a guy you are. Not what you've been, what you are. An inventory is what you have on hand. Don't take a financial statement of 10 years ago up to a bank and try to loan money on it. They'll think you're crazy. You got to take a present statement. That's your inventory. And so he helped me and we looked. And of course, the first thing I put on was dishonesty. And intolerance. And procrastination. And not indifference. And lust. I put down quite a list of them. And with my sponsor. And he says, now here are the principles you're going to have to practice in order to change your habit pattern. Now you don't have to get rid of your dishonesty. You don't have to get rid of your procrastination. You don't have to get rid of your resentments. All you have to do is practice the principles and they'll abandon you like a rat abandons a sinking ship. Because you can't be dishonest when you're honest. You can't be indifferent when you start caring. You can't procrastinate when you do things promptly. All the things the program asks you is what you do. It doesn't ask you to get rid of a thing. It asks you to accept something and practice it. Your defects of character will disappear. Not at once. Because you've got to do something else, the program says. You have to practice these principles. And that's beautiful, it says that. It says you'd have to do your best. And the reason you practice is to improve. The definition of practice is that it's an honest endeavor to improve yourself. It isn't to make you perfect. Practice makes perfect is a bunch of you know what. Nobody's perfect. That's a fallacy. Practice does not make perfect. Practice makes you better. I was a good friend of Ted Williams, the greatest batter of all time. He was known for his practicing. And he practiced, and he practiced. And went into the service 3 years in his prime, and in spite of that, he broke most records that were ever broken in batting. And he did it by practicing. He never got perfect. He could only hit the ball 4 out of 10 times. And yet he was the greatest. And he kept practicing. Why? To be perfect? No. To improve himself. And that's what we do. We practice these principles to improve ourselves. And that's why it says, the finishing part of the step says that. Well, I got into the fifth step and found out that I didn't have to spill my guts to one person. I didn't have enough guts to spill it all to one person. I wasn't going to let anybody have that much on me. I went and talked it over with my sponsor. And he says, another, you got something you want to get rid of? And I says, yes, I got about three items. That ain't all, but that's the ones that's starting to bother me. And so him and I talked them over, and I got relief. And from time to time, I'd take some of these things as they come up, and my memory got better, and I remembered things. And I, till this day, I'm finding out there's some things that I want to discuss with my sponsor. And I want to get off my chest. And I kept on this program, and I got up to where it said, you make amends. Well, who in the hell can make the amends for all the stuff I've done? It's impossible. Here this program wants me to make all those amends. And then I kept reading it, and it didn't say that. It said, be willing to make amends. And I searched myself and found out that I was willing. If I were able, I were willing. And I found out by thinking it over and thinking it over and talking it over some, that's all that was necessary, is that I was honestly willing to make amends wherever possible. Now, a lot of people have almost ruined their marriages by going to their wife and started making amends and doing it. When I got back together with my wife, she finally invited me back into the home after 27 months, which was a tremendous emotional experience. I had given up the fact I was ever going to live at home anymore. And we were sitting in the living room one night, and I said, Lil, the program urges us to make amends, and I've got a lot of them to make you, and I'd like to talk them over with you. And she says, Shorty, I know a little bit about the program. I've gone to Al-Anon. And she says, the biggest amends you can make, and the most complete amends you can make, is to stay sober and to support your family in a reasonable manner. That's the amends. I don't want to sit here and discuss all the things that you did to me and the family and everybody else. I don't want to open up those old sores. I just want you to know that I'll settle for what you're doing now, and I think it's wonderful, and I thank God for it. So I got rid of the one that I was the most worried about, and my wife helped me get rid of it. And I'm satisfied we're doing it right. After all, we've been married a little while, and we can live together. We found that out. And then I went on and into the program, and I got up to the 11th step. And my God, here it said it's sought through prayer and meditation. I say medication once in a while. We had a woman that come to the program, and she says, I'm praying and I'm taking medication. It still isn't doing any good. And sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. And then praying only for knowledge of His will for us in the power to carry it out. And I did some tremendous thinking on this. And then I realized that I had been listening to these people whose God's will was, and they turn it over to God, and God's taking care of it, and everything is they're doing, telling God what He's got to do and what He's going to do and all that. And I kind of looked upon their God as kind of a sucker. He's doing all their work for them. And so I realized in reading the part that what God wanted me to do was practice these principles in all my affairs. God had laid out a set of principles for me to practice. And He wasn't out to get me, He was out to reward me. And to the extent I practiced these principles, to that extent I would have it good. And my God has saw to it religiously along that line. And so God's will for me is to practice these principles to the best of my ability. Now that's my understanding. That's the way I worked. No, I'm not telling you folks how to work the program. I'm telling you how I work it. Get in there and dig and get your own program. And you'll be happy. And you'll have a good life. And you won't call your sponsor a liar like I called him when he first talked to me. He said one of the most ridiculous things there was. He says, Shorty, after you've been sober a while, you're going to be glad you're sober. Who in the hell's going to be glad they're sober? I'd resign myself. There wasn't going to be any fun, but I couldn't do anything else. And I worked this program, and I run into words, and I tried to figure them out. And I got into service. And there were some words that I had to go to the dictionary for. The one was spiritual. I asked three different guys what the word spiritual meant, and they gave me three different answers. So I went to the San Francisco Library, and I asked where the dictionaries were, and they showed me a shelf that had 22 different kinds of dictionaries. I laid all 22 of them out on that long table there and opened every one to the word spiritual, and boy, the definitions they had. That woven in amongst them, there were seven places, and amongst all those dictionaries, it said something that rung a bell for me, and which I have adapted and had no reason to disbelieve that it wasn't the right definition. It said all things that are not material are spiritual. And I thought about that, and I started walking down the hill, and I started thinking about what they were teaching me on the program. They were trying to teach me to be honest. Well, that wasn't a material act. It had to be spiritual. They're teaching me to be tolerant. Everything the program was teaching me wasn't material. So it had to be spiritual. So I accepted it along that line. And that got that one out of the woods for me. And the same with other words I looked up. And then I was going to have a birthday. Well, heck, you guys don't have to leave. Then I was going to have a birthday, and I was so jealous of everybody that had a year and 2 years and 3 years, and I couldn't say anything because I didn't have my year yet, and if I did, I'd have to say 30 days or something, and my ego wouldn't let me admit to such a small amount. Then my first birthday come along, I was still out of a steady job, and the guy that came on the same night as I did, Ted, his name was, he came on, and we both had our birthday together, and he came to the birthday with a good-looking dame on his arm, a brand-new Buick automobile, and he'd been restored to his job as superintendent of the San Francisco Plumbing and Heating Company, a big company. He and his girlfriend had been out to Sausalito trying to pick a new house. And there I am in sleeveless shirt, a duck trouser, part-time job. And I thought, what the hell? Here I am, I go to 7 meetings a week, and here Ted goes to 1 a week, and look what AA dishes out for him. And look what it leaves for me. And I got up and I left. And I started walking down that hill to the club, and I'd like to say a voice on high started talking to me, but it wasn't. I started talking to myself. And I said to myself, Shorty, where were you a year ago tonight? How did you feel a year ago tonight? Did you have any friends a year ago tonight? Did you have a club you could go and play pinochle at a year ago tonight? Did you have a roof over your head a year ago tonight? And I started thinking, and I realized that I'd committed perhaps the most unforgivable sin you can commit in AA, and that's compare yourself with others. That the only comparison I have a right to is what I was like and what I'm like now. And if I can see some progress, I haven't too much to worry about. So I got over that hump. But then I got to my third birthday. And, I was really proud, but gee, it had taken so long. And so I went back up to the club after the meeting, and the manager says, Shorty, haven't you got a birthday around now sometime? I says, yeah, it's today. How many years are you sober? And I says, it's going on 4. And when I was 4 years sober, it was going on 5. And when I was 5 years sober, I woke up that I was just kidding myself. And I quit doing that. And I know people that have done it, and they've got mixed up. And I have a person I know real well, that when I was sober 21 years, he was sober 18 years. And when I was sober 35 years, he was sober 38 years. He just doesn't know how to count. But it's been, it was last January, it was 40 years since I took my last drink. And if you think I've forgotten the date, I haven't. It's January 23rd, 1949. It was during an era in AA when we had a lot of things happening. There was fear of destroying AA because of some things that were being done. But we weathered them. And we have to be good guardians of AA and not run AA. We got to return to being servants, trusted servants. Not ordained leaders. We'll get in trouble every time we do. And don't be afraid to stand up for what you know is honestly right. I'm going to give you an example of it. I don't very seldom tell it. But when I was delegate, the chairman said, we have something that we want done. Telephone girls all over the nation that answer the AA phone get themselves wrapped up too long with the people that are seeking information. And they're always asking, being asked, who's an alcoholic? And what's an alcoholic? And who's eligible to join? And we would like you to us to put out a circular telling them all they need to say. If they ask who can join, just to say, anybody that's an alcoholic, that knows they're an alcoholic, can join AA. And you know, it was almost a unanimous vote for that. And there was one lone Swede, when they says, are there any objection? He raised his hand. And Bob Hitchens, the chairman, says, what the hell's your objection, Shorty? And I says, I'm glad you asked. And I went out to the center of the floor to the microphone, and I explained to them, we had not been sent here to change the third tradition. We had not been sent here to make a decision like that. We should have been pre-advised so we could gone to our groups and got group conscience on it. I am not about to stand for something like this. And then a guy by the name of Hal Morley from Washington, D.C. stood up and he says, change my vote to go with Shorty. A little while later, another guy did. One guy got up and says, let's read the third tradition. And he read it. And then a man stood up and says, I move that we rescind our past action and all go along with Shorty. And every single one stood up. And I stood in the middle of the floor crying. But this is our program. The groups, the group conscience is the power. That's where you get sober. Like Dr. Norris told me, he says, you know, I'm afraid of group conscience because they're not informed. I says, informed of what? What do you know about the alcoholic? How many new men have ever come up to the central office and sought to be sober? Where do they go to seek help? They go to the groups. The group has got the prime information, has got the right information. Don't ever say, they need to be informed before they make a decision. They are informed. The mere fact we're growing shows that the groups are informed. Leave the groups alone. They'll support you if you do. I believe that to this day. And we've gone the other way from time to time. We've did nothing but suffer for it. Now you young folks, You know, I'm an old bleeding deacon. And some of you try awful hard to change me. But one thing you better not try to change, and that is that I believe with all my heart that you belong here. You're just as eligible to this program as us old-timers. If you will meet the requirements of AA, you belong around here. We can't get along without you. And I want you to know that comes from me. And if you got some old bleeding deacon that looks down their nose at you, let me know who he is so I can stay away from him. Because I don't want to catch his illness. But you have got to follow the same path regardless of age. There's nothing in the book that says, if you are under 16, here's the chapter you read. If you're under 30, here's the chapter you read. If you're under 40, here's the chapter you read. We all are alcoholics, period, that want to do something about our drinking. And we all have to use the same method. My group, the grassroots group in Kennewick, Washington, we have men all ages in there. And they stay sober. And they don't know that they've got to go to some special group to get special treatment because they're special alcoholics. They come there and they hear just what all of it. They get to listen to some people that are staying sober. I went to a young people's group and there wasn't a person there with a year's sobriety. The blind were leading the blind something terrible. And they didn't belong. Now, I don't say there shouldn't be special meetings. But special groups, no. No. 1,000 times no. We're going to be so spattered all over the world with special groups we won't know a genuine group when we see one. Now, let's be careful. Let's be good trustees. Maybe that's a signal I've talked too long. When I am doing my closing remarks, so take a deep breath. When I was first on the program, I was asked by my sponsor to go listen to a speaker. His name was Lloyd Bowers. Lloyd Bowers at Roseville, California. He's one of the oldest members in AA in California, a lawyer. And he came to that meeting and I listened to him. And he was beautiful because my sponsor told me that he was one of the real pillars in AA. And of course, I'd gotten along far enough, so I was ambitious. I wanted to be a pillar in AA. And so I listened to him, and what a marvelous talk he made. And he was a grand man. I got more acquainted with him. And one day, I'm sorry, Irene, I caught the cold. And one day, they invited me to talk over in Sausalita, and I came back across the bridge from it, and the guy that drove me over there said, "You did real fine." And I thought, uh-uh, I'm on my way now. On my way. But of course, I started doing some sane thinking and realized it was going to take more than that. And then when I come up into Washington and they selected me as the chairman of the Washington area, and I was driving home to White Salmon, and I said to myself, well, Shorty, you're a pillar in AA. You have to be. You're a chairman over this whole area. And there's only one chairman in the whole area. You got to be a pillar. And as I drove along, I started reasoning that maybe AA wouldn't entirely collapse if there weren't any state chairman. And then I got selected to be the delegate. And I'm driving home from Spokane, and knowing that now I'm a pillar in AA. And then, of course, that little stinker that gets in your mind starts straightening you out. I realized that maybe if there weren't any delegates, it might not run quite as smooth, but it wouldn't collapse. I'm sure of that. So I realized I hadn't become a pillar in AA. And then one day I'm driving up the Yakima River and I come to Toppenish. It's a Sunday night. I'm traveling on the road, and I'm going to get to Yakima to stay overnight. And I'm driving up the road, and I realize that in just a few minutes they're going to have a meeting in Toppenish. 8 o'clock Sunday night, Indian Reservation. And so I knew where it was, a little store and right along the railroad tracks, little old building. And I pull up, there's one car in front, a light in the window. Stick my head in the door, and I say, "Hi, Harry." He says, "Hi, Shorts." I says, "Am I early?" He says, "No." He says, "Are you alone?" "Yep." "You mean if I hadn't come, you'd be alone?" "Yep." "How long you been sober?" 9 years. I says, "Do you come down here every Sunday night like this?" "Yep." I says, "How many of your Indian friends have come to see you in these 9 years?" He says, "Oh, I've been able to talk to five." I says, "Just a minute, Harry. You do all this, dress yourself up, neatly barbered, got a desk here, and got literature on it, and got a coffee pot over there, got a dozen donuts, and got four chairs out in front there in case somebody comes. Why do you do it?" He says, "The book tells me I should try to keep it available, and this is the only way I know how. Thank you very much. I met my pillar in the road."